I would like to welcome you to the fifth lecture in the colloquy entitled Sexuality, A Search for Perspective. Tonight's talk is the second on this week's general subject, Cultural Perspectives. A sixth all-university lecture will be held tomorrow when we will hear from Gerhard Neubeck from the University of Minnesota, speaking on the subject, Attraction is a Constant, the Internationalism of Sex. I'd like to encourage all of you to continue your participation in this colloquy next week when we will hear Dr. Rollo May, psychologist, Violet Lindbeck, sociologist, and Calvin Herndon, sociologist, speak on sexual roles in American society. I would like now to present to you Dr. Ruth Yuseem, who will introduce tonight's speaker. Dr. Yuseem is professor of education with the Institute of International Studies in Education and the Human Learning Research Institute. She also holds an appointment as professor of sociology. Her PhD is in sociology, anthropology, and social psychology from the University of Wisconsin. She has been at MSU since 1951. Dr. Yuseem is internationally known for her writings and research. She and her husband, Dr. John Yuseem, also a professor of sociology at MSU, compose one of the better-known husband and wife teams in higher education today. Will you please welcome Dr. Ruth Yuseem.
Well, this is one time when that trite phrase, it gives me great pleasure to introduce, is no longer a trite phrase. Perhaps this small fact is one of the most significant things that I can say about our speaker of the evening. He has that peculiar capacity to make trite things significant and to make trivia into matters of moment. The formal biographical sketch of Dr. Weston LaBarre of Duke University is available to all of you. His publications are, as the name implies, a matter of public record. Hence, I need not elaborate on these aspects. But what I would like to elaborate on is that which is not so public. Dr. LaBarre is an anthropologist. But as an anthropologist, he is unique among most of anthropology. For some anthropologists get hung up on a particular culture and talk about my people, the Dakotas, or my people, the Athabascans. But Dr. LaBarre has never been identified with a culture, a nation, a society, a system, or even the establishment. He is just identified with members of the family of mankind. For there are no boundaries on his capacity to empathize with any human beings, whatever their race, their gender, their citizenship, their ethnicity, or their patterns of behavior. In other words, he has an enormous love and yet critical respect for the human animal. No matter what the varieties of or the complexities of the behavior. To him, nothing human is alien. But not all of that which is humanly contrived is acceptable. He is ruthlessly honest in his recording of the varieties of human experience, but he is also quietly courageous in his assessment of the meanings of these happenings for the survival of his beloved human animal. To his immense learning, he brings wisdom. Wisdom which is not the cant from the past, but the new wisdom which gives us hope for creating a quality future. Dr. LaBarre, as an anthropologist, also sets no boundary lines in disciplines. He combines culture and personality, physical anthropology, cultural anthropology, is open to psychiatry, psychology, and sociology. What kind of a man, though, is Dr. LaVar? I see him as a lonesome, introspective, self-examining, creative individual. I see him as an explorer of inner space. Now, we have many advocates on the exploration of inner space who are abroad in the land today. But there's a real difference between Dr. LaVar when he looks into inner space and the many other practitioners of the art. For he has more inner space to examine. When Dr. LaVar goes into the field, as it says on your formal bibliography, that he's been in 13 different American Indian tribes in Europe, Latin America, and Asia. When he goes into the field, he doesn't look coolly and aloofly at the, quote, natives. He tries to feel what they feel, do what they do, experience what they experience. This is a lonesome, painful process, to lose yourself over and over again in trying to get into the inner space of others. Then he withdraws to examine that which he has absorbed, not to relive it, but to make meaningful summaries and draw out the meaning and portent. Hence, when he withdraws unto himself, he is not escaping from people, but trying to reach out to people, for he has internalized them within himself. But it's not just as an anthropologist, the style of life of an anthropologist. Dr. LaVar is also a very human family man, one who designs his living space to maximize the quality of daily interaction. I can testify to this, that he even grows African violets in his bathroom. He is also not a man who ritually sends embossed Christmas cards, but who personalizes in a hand so cramped and tiny that I have to get out my magnifying glass, a Christmas card of renewal of friendship. He is a man who carries in his briefcase not only a manuscript, but leaf cuttings to take to his son. It is not surprising that in this home setting and out of this home setting, the introduction to his book, The Human Animal, reads, "To my wife, my sons, and my daughter, who taught me these things." We can safely predict that in the future he will be taught much more, for now he is a grandfather of a new granddaughter who will also teach him more. Perhaps the greatest peon that anyone can, of praise that anyone can give to a great man, is to say that not only his family loves and respects him, but also likes him. And I can attest that all members of his family love, respect, and like him. I commend to you then a man of passion and a man of compassion, a learned man and a wise man, a gentleman and a gentle man. I know of no one that I can more highly recommend to look at sexuality, that characteristic common to all of Dr. LaVar's kinfolk, who can give us the anthropological perspective on sexuality.
Ruth, I love you too. In trying to discuss the problem of sexuality, I feel as though I were asked to answer that probably apocryphal quiz question. Discuss the universe and give two examples. Because there are two. Anthropology, as the comparative study of man, is a mixture of biological, historical, psychological, and social sciences. While this often provides broad-range opportunities for interfertilization, it also forces the anthropologist sometimes to be neat about his categories and the location of his subject matter. There are at least 10 levels on which we can discuss human sexuality, and these can be put into 3 major groupings. Primary sexuality means the physical anatomical givens of sex, and these are, 1, histological or cellular sex, that is the XXXY patternings of chromosomes in the individual. Recently, there's been some discussion of the supermale type with an XYY chromosome pattern. This appears with some frequency in the criminal psychopath, as though an anomalous double endowment with Y has burdened the individual with amounts of masculine behavioral aggressivity that foredoomed him to a life of crime. 2, gonadal sex, that is, whether the sex glands produce eggs or sperm. 3, external genital anatomy, concerning which there's sometimes considerable ambiguity, since maleness and femaleness are based on the same embryological ground plan, and analogous genital organs are in part a matter of size, as well as of differentiated shape and function. Administration of hormones, or surgery, or both, can correct some of these ambiguities. But often it is a matter of judgment as to what to do, depending on other factors of the individual's upbringing and personal choice. Of course, also, it is sometimes possible to change surgically an anatomically normal person of one sex into a synthetic specimen of the other sex. But this is a matter of psychopathology, not of the primary sexuality being discussed here. 4, anatomy of the internal accessory reproductive structures. Without sufficient study, it is possible to modify external genitalia surgically, but inconsistently with the internal sexual morphology. 5, in addition to these primary anatomical givens, there are also secondary sexual characteristics, and these traits of secondary sexuality are those aspects of gross maleness and femaleness in texture and body proportions and conformation that appear largely at adolescence in response to hormones, such as wide hips versus wide shoulders, presence and distribution of body hair, fat, and so forth. Now, since both male and female sex glands produce both male and female hormones, we have here not so much a sharp dichotomy as a gamut or mosaic of traits. The actual constellation of these traits within a wide but normal range can cause much psychological anguish in the adolescent individual whose body is undergoing these physical changes. In fact, even thoroughly male or female changes can cause shock or distress. Additionally, physical traits that offend cultural stereotypes, for example, shortness in a man or tallness in a woman, can cause suffering and psychological scars in individuals otherwise entirely normal sexually. In fact, I know a male psychiatrist who suffered from a height that was excessively masculine for a man of his generation, but would pass unnoticed in the taller present generation. Again, in our wealthy country, a woman has to struggle hard to keep thin, whereas in Turkey, the admired woman would be regarded by us as extremely fat. What should be emphatically noted here is the plain fact of wide, normal variation in these physical hormonal traits of maleness and femaleness. Biological evolution proceeds on the basis of differences within the species, so that we should abhor too standardized a conformity to pattern. What would seem a physical anomaly now may be conceivably the wave of the future. Likewise, cultural evolution depends upon psychological uniqueness in culture heroes. so that we should actively seek those socio-politico-economic conditions that promote, protect, and cherish a high degree of individuality. From a personal point of view, we should learn to take these secondary variations as not much more important than being blonde or brunette or redheaded. Admittedly, racial variations are precious for the future of the total human species. Here in America, through lucky historical accidents, we have large pools of Mongoloid genes in the American Indian, of Negro genes through importation of slaves, and of Caucasoid genes through European migration. And yet, some people are unhappy about our enormous and undeserved and unsurpassed opportunities for hybrid vigor in the future. Therefore, anyone can be mildly gratified at representing in his body racial differences, though he can take no moral credit for it personally. At the same time, having a black or white or yellow or red skin has been vastly overrated in the past as indicating any special relationship to individual cultural potentiality. Civilization requires a wide range of variety in people for its purposes. However much these differences have frightened us in tribal days in the past. Similarly, physical differences in secondary sexual characteristics are just not that important to one's potential as a human person. And gross physical traits can be misleading too. In parachute school, the most gutsy and virile man I knew was a fragile-looking little college professor, whereas several of the giant athletic males were physical and moral cowards. In addition to these primary and secondary sexual characteristics, there is a category I call tertiary sexual characteristics. These are the psychological traits of masculinity and femininity, and from now on, my talk will deal exclusively with these. Masculinity and femininity are not at all the simple dichotomy of traits that they seem to be. There are three or four aspects of tertiary sexuality that must be discriminated here. Sixth in my list is the sex of assignment in rearing. Most boys are reared as males and girls as females. But commonly enough, pathological parents will rear a boy in feminine fashion and a girl in masculine fashion. It is not simply a matter of dressing a boy in girl's clothes. It is a more subtle matter. Each parent is of one sex or the other and has definite ideas, conscious and unconscious, about the fact of his or her sex. Further, each parent has definite attitudes toward the other sex, toward the spouse in particular, toward sons versus daughters, and toward one son or daughter versus another son or daughter. Sometimes a neurotic family seems even to select unconsciously the individual who will be officially sick for it, although the others may be just as sick or sicker. Also, the relationship of parents to one another changes and develops, and hence children born at different times are subjected to a different parental climate. The sex-age composition of children in the family is also part of the complex accidents that have real and permanent psychological effects. For example, having many sons masculinizes a father. A father who really does not like women, in spite of great masculine protest in his official hypervirility in admiring all things male, this kind of a father may in effect masculinize his daughter, simply because, unconsciously to both, he has rewarded her selectively for masculine behaviors, but has taught her contempt for feminine behavior. That is, tertiary sexual characteristics are to a large degree psychologically learned. Again, an hysteroid mother may subtly behave quite seductively and castratively toward an older son, but not toward younger sons. Sometimes the unconscious conflict between parents over sex of assignment to a child will directly shape conflict in a child over his sexual identity. To summarize, sex of assignment is a category that applies not merely to the extreme case of a male child reared in dresses, and not merely to the familiar parent-shaped sissy or tomboy, but in subtler ways that apply to every single human being. The matter can reach unsuspected complexity in cases we see clinically. For example, a mother may acknowledge her son's maleness, but teach him to despise it. And a father may court his daughter and her femininity and teach her to overvalue it. 7, there are several more aspects of tertiary sexuality, gender role and gender orientation. Both of these are learned, and both are established in the social rearing process. In fact, just as there is an imprinting period during which one does or does not learn to speak, so also I believe there is an imprinting period between 3 and 5 years of age in which gender role and gender orientation are sometimes irrevocably set. Gender role is the teaching of what males are like and what females are like in terms of the society's contemporary stereotypes. Let me describe the nature of gender role through an anecdote. The late Dr. Alfred Kinsey was really a fine fellow, and he had a connoisseur's knowledge of exotic foods. But when he interviewed me, now some decades ago, it was soon clear to me that he was enormously naive psychologically and psychiatrically. I did not tell him so at the time, but for some reason, after World War II, he asked me to join his research group as an anthropologist. I refused because his research questionnaire had already taught me its severe limitations. And I don't mean in a self-congratulatory way the usual samplings of errors of sampling or class or regional or racial bias and so on that he's already been massively criticized for, but I mean something much more pervasive and massive. Ignoring all the methodological defects of his pioneering work, what did Kinsey actually discover? Basically, that the human male is extremely oversexed, in spite of all the varied outlets, quote unquote, he manages to find for himself. Now, this view is easy enough to accept. First place, it fits our stereotypes. It's also very flattering. In the third place, every human male that ever lived has surely had some problem in the management of his sexual impulses, as conceivably the human female has had too. When Kinsey's first book came out, I remember telling my wife, "Aha, so that's it. Now I will predict for you what the human female will be like." Sure enough, she is. The human female is grievously undersexed. She's not interested in sexual fantasy, in male nudity, in pictures, in pornographic words, in anything. In fact, she couldn't care less. And if it were left up to her sexual desire alone, the human race would become extinct in one generation. Now, perhaps this is a bit exaggerated, but that's the essential message of the second volume. Now, your generation, whose source of mythology about sex is Playboy magazine, knows that Kinsey's notions about women are simply not so. That fold-out girl is 100% willing from the word go and is just waiting for you to come along. Sex takes no time or effort or involvement at all. It's as simple as turning on or off the TV set. And every well-equipped bachelor's apartment should have this facility. Plainly, what Kinsey has discovered is not the sexual nature of the human male and female. He discovered the folklore about sex in this society and in that generation. That is to say, each generation has sets of largely unconscious stereotypes about male and female. And these are a part of the covert and unofficial, but constantly changing culture. Your generation, for example, in contrast with the Victorian one at least, has decided that there is really not very much difference psychologically between men and women. Being of another persuasion than you, another generation, I'm not sure that I subscribe to that either. Now, a moment's reflection would demonstrate that all these must be stereotypes if they're going to change so with each generation. Genetics cannot change that fast. Again, if the male is really the more urgently sexed, why did Holy Writ, in which all things are true, represent that Adam was sitting under a tree, picking his nose and selling his papers, and along comes Eve, and she seduces him? Looks as though a different unconscious stereotype was at work here. What about those late medieval chansons de geste also? In one of them, a knight is riding along in the woods, his mind on lofty and important things like crusades and tournaments and honor and such. His strength was as the strength of 10 because his heart was pure, and besides, his wife was safely locked up as she should be in a chastity girdle back in the castle. When he comes to a humble woodcutter's hut where he must spend the night, I need not repeat in this public place and before a mixed audience all the details about the woodcutter's daughter. But the anthropological generalization one could make from the encounter is that if he could not care less, she was urgently oversexed and even rapaciously predatory. As a matter of fact, given our different stereotypes and expectancies, she was like a Swedish woman seems to an American man. Remember the shock some years back when a prominent Swedish actress behaved as though a woman had a legitimate right to be consciously interested in sexuality. Worse yet, acted as if she had a choice in the matter. This is no isolated finding. There are many cultures in which female sexual aggressiveness surpasses the males. For example, the Kupel of Northwest Amazonia, among whom the men complain that the women are too ardent. Among the upper-class Tuareg of North Africa, the female courtiers and troubadours are the sexual aggressors, and the males are the guardians of decorum. An upper-class Tuareg warrior would blush deeply in the love court of the lady troubadours if his veil slipped. Men wear veils here, not women. Now, in addition to this matter of gender role, that is, what people think males and females are like in terms of their nature and behavior, there's another dimension in tertiary sexuality, gender orientation. Now, as opposed to gender role, which is a cultural model of expectancies, gender orientation is an individual perspective. This is a question of a self-judgment as to how one fits the fashions in sexual behavior, and B, one's conscious and unconscious preferences about how he feels and what he wants to be sexually. There's possibly also C, the quote-unquote objective judgment of others as to how well the individual matches the stereotypes in his behavior. These are all really different. For example, a girl might think that A, she had managed to present a seemly facade for modest feminine behavior, but B, secretly wished she had a man's choices and freedom, whereas C, others judged her as having cat's claws in her velvet gloves, or as a predatory but frustrating teaser. Perhaps a sharper focus can be given by using comparative ethnographic material. Every Plains Indian, male or female, young and old, knew what the gender role of an adult male was. He was an instinctual and total warrior. All his life energy was bent toward killing other men, collecting scalps and other trophies, and capturing as many women and horses as he can. To this end, about puberty, he went on a lone vision quest to fast and pray for 4 days and nights, so that hopefully he could obtain medicine power. Now, this is a different notion about adolescence. We think that adolescence comes from internal autogenous unfolding. They think the difference between a child and an adult is something that comes in from outside. It's a kind of packaged virility that he seeks that would help him carry out his male role. If he were lucky, he actually got this package, that is, his medicine bundle of supernatural, magical malehood. Perhaps he'd find a feather, or a strange-looking stone, or bone, or a weasel would run by, and he would shoot at it for his medicine bundle container. The Blackfoot actually had so many medicine bundles that they constituted the major wealth of the tribe that was traded back and forth for other commodities. Now, there was a variation to this. Some men got medicine power not to kill, but to cure. These individuals became medicine men, or shamans, and they could do everything from curing wounds, diagnosing causes, and diagnosing the persons causing diseases, and sucking out disease-producing objects, to seeing the enemy impossibly far off in space and distant in future time, and supernaturally protecting his war party, to controlling the weather. There were only two kinds of male gender role in the plains, warrior or medicine man. But in actual fact, there was still a third kind of male, the nut man, or berdash, berdache. Lewis and Clark and other explorers and scouts give us many accounts of the berdash in the tribes they encountered. Many thought they were hermaphrodites, or at least sexually perverse, when as a matter of fact, they were not necessarily either. The berdash, or not man, was first and foremost only a social transvestite. That is, he wore women's clothes and performed women's roles. His not man status of not being either a warrior or a medicine man was simply announced by his wearing women's clothes. Like everyone else, he knew perfectly well the male gender role, but he had a stubborn preference for his own gender orientation. Psychologically, it is fairly easy to explain the berdash to a generation that can imagine other things a male might do besides going off to be killed in Vietnam or collecting a lot of green printed paper. Psychologically, we are to understand that the berdash may even have had a more vivid and imaginative view of the male gender role than the average man. That is to say, he could imagine all too well what it would be like to be scalped or mutilated or killed, so much so that he wants to get out of that bag. But the male gender role is so rigidly defined that he has literally only one way to do so. That is to become a male dropout or transvestite. The discrepancy here between male gender role, as expected, and gender orientation in some individuals is so great that Plains Indians have to rationalize it on supernatural grounds. For example, when the berdash went out on the usual vision quest at puberty, instead of a snake or a bear or thunderbird or the sun, there appeared to him the moon. In one hand, she held a bow and arrow. In the other, she held an elk rib, such as women use to scrape skins in tanning. Naturally, he reached out for the bow and arrow. But the moon smiled, crossed her arms, and what he grasped was the elk rib scraper. Thus, when he came back from the vision quest, he had to take up women's work and roles. He had no choice. We would say in our sophisticated day that the supernatural compulsion came from his subconscious mind. His castration anxiety about being scalped or mutilated was so intense that his social role was mutilated. But no matter how we explain it, it came to the same end. He could never go to war and collect scalps and horses and feathers for a war bonnet. The price of abdicating from the proud masculine game of prestige warfare and its status rewards was to wear a feminine garb. Perhaps we can understand the emotional intensity of these visual signals of a preferred role. In our society, an older generation goes into a frenzy if a young male lets both his face hair and his head hair grow at the same time. It is as confusing and anxiety-arousing as when boys and girls wear much the same clothes and have much the same attitudes toward the world. They do not fit the sharp dichotomies the older generation expects and is comfortable with, or at least struggles to conform to. Further details concerning the Beardash are interesting and edifying. Having made the public transvestite statement, and having paid the price in potential status, the Beardash now has some freedom of conscious and unconscious choice sexually. One Beardash may marry and have children, all the while wearing women's clothes. Married to a not man, his wife may seem to be a lesbian, but she emphatically is not. Another Beardash may elect to be a permanent bachelor, or rather a permanent spinster, a complete sexual dropout. Another may become a kind of surreptitious male prostitute for other men. And still another, being officially a woman, may marry another man. Among the Mojave, the Beardash may, in fact, pretend to menstruate by making his inner thighs bleed, and even pretend to bear children. But curiously enough, it's not the Beardash, but the man who marries the Beardash, who suffers social obloquy from such a marriage. The Indian rationale is clear. So male-oriented a system is it that, being anatomically a male, the Beardash is expected to do women's work, even better than women do. A high form of praise might be, "She does beadwork as fine as a Beardash's." This is not, however, the cause of the shame to the husband of a Beardash. After all, a man is entitled to as fine a beadworker in his spouse as he can attain to. It is rather that the Beardash might go hunting buffalo for her husband. And I'm a little confused about these genders. This is the last straw. It's not fair. The poor stick of a man, husband of the Beardash, was giving up the ultimate male role, that of hunting game for food. In this, the Indians feel something like we do when a man marries a rich woman. True, he gains buying power, which is the basis of male prestige. But this buying power gives such a man no status or validation of his masculinity, because the wealth here depends on the prior activity of another male, his wife's father or her former husband. And besides, he gains wealth not in the masculine way, by earning it in competition with other men, but in a feminine way, by marrying it. The man who marries a rich woman is really no better than a woman who's married for money. Worse yet, he has sold his male birthright to the game of status competition and for mere money. I ask you to examine the irony of this. He's only a high-class male whore. Plains Indians have one more way of escaping the burdensome an anxiety-laden job of being a male. But this way is one of extremely high prestige, becoming a crazy dog. In many plains tribes, a man rises in life through joining successively higher and higher ranked warriors' dancing societies as he has collected more scalps and women and prestige by counting coup. That is, ritually touching a fallen but still dangerous enemy with a little wooden coup stick. The warrior and dancing societies are graded in prestige, like fraternities or college clubs. The difference being that he moves from one to the other as he advances in rank. Only a very high-ranking warrior would aspire to be a crazy dog, for no man would take him seriously otherwise. He chooses this role for himself. He must be full of supernatural power, they would say, because he shows his new aspiration through stylized negativism, both in speech and in behavior. If he says one thing, he means the opposite. And he is so contrary that his wife must tell him to go away if she wants him to come to a meal. That's a real crazy dog. But the final test of a crazy dog is his contrariness to common sense in war, the masculine arena, when he exposes himself to extravagant dangers. Among the Kiowa Indians, for example, he wears a long sash that trails on the ground. In a hypothetical case, a party of Yanktonai Sioux are approaching on the war path, so he shoots an arrow into the sash and tethers himself to the ground, as if he could not escape when the rest of the group sensibly retreats. What he is saying symbolically is, I will take on alone all you Yanktonai and all your friends, the Hunk Papa Sioux, the Brule, yes, and the Teton Dakota too. Understandably, most scholars regard this behavior as a form of ritual suicide, for this is what it in fact amounts to. But in what a blaze of glory the warrior leaves life. If by remote chance he survives the onslaught and crawls back, minus scalp or an eye or a leg or two, he's accorded the greatest respect and honor. Naturally, the mortality rate among crazy dogs is rather high, and there are never very many of them around at one time. Perhaps in our society, we have the equivalent in prestige terms. The man who makes $1 million by the time he's 35 and then dies of a coronary attack at 36. One must not suppose that there are any great number then, either of crazy dogs or of Berdaches in any plains tribe at any one time, but probably no more per capita than millionaires among us. Both are admittedly extreme cases, but they are recognized and socially visible roles and are yet quite understandable in terms of the culture, its norms, and its goals. Perhaps more ordinary would be my friend Bert Crowlance, now dead, so that his revealing visions can be told, and psychologists can interpret them any way they will. Bert had an accident that partly crippled him for work, so he hoped to get a vision that would reveal to him diamonds, or short of that, oil in his share in Oklahoma. The first time he went out, he tried and tried to get a vision, but without success. Finally, his mother appeared to him in a dream and said, "You might as well go back, Bert. You forgot your pipe." Next time, well armed with his tobacco pipe, he was flying through the air in fine fettle and spotted a place. But as he got closer, he was afraid to land. The place was full of frightening snake men. So Bert Crowlance never got diamonds or oil either in Oklahoma. It's already apparent that there are 9 comparative cultural norms for tertiary sexual characteristics of masculinity and femininity. Some of these are purely behavioral expectancies. When 2 Berber men walk hand in hand in North Africa, means nothing concerning the gender of their morals, but only simple friendship. 50 years ago, Appalachian males exchanged the holy kiss mouth to mouth, before snake handling meetings in church. The secular heterosexual kiss in public would be unthinkable, especially at church. Indeed, in earlier European times, men often kissed one another in public, as when knight greeted knight, or noble his cousin noble. In context, this was as meaningless sexually as men wearing silk, lace, and long hair in 18th century Europe. This was far more a matter of wealth and status difference than of sexual difference. The best known evidence for culturally varying tertiary sexual characteristics is from Margaret Mead's Three New Guinea Tribes. Both sexes among the Arapesh have feminine nurturant traits, because the main dichotomy for them is not into male versus female, but rather grown versus ungrown persons. Males and females are actually, in this tribe, regarded as functional equivalents, alike. They differ only in that the father feeds the fetus from his body before the birth, and the mother feeds the baby after the birth. A young man grows his little fiancée by nurturing and feeding her. Premature sexuality between them is frowned upon, not because of any puritanical anti-sexuality as such, but rather because one should achieve his or her growth before contributing to the growth of another human being, that is, one's children. With proper behavior in this respect, Arapesh can then believe the self-fulfilling fantasy that sexuality inhibits growth, since one is full grown before he practices intercourse. Among the fierce headhunting Mundugumor, both males and females are, in our terms, tough, self-sufficient, and masculine, because as children, they were let out as hostages in enemy tribes to keep the peace, and they had to learn to take care of themselves in a hostile, uncaring environment. And finally, among the Chambali, women are masculine and men are feminine in temperament by our standards. In the old native days, men were preoccupied with headhunting and war rituals, while women did most of the economically productive work. But when the British forbade headhunting and war, the Chambali men became technologically unemployed, and their old war rituals gradually developed into elaborate theatrical dramas. Men became excessively concerned with dress and appearance. They became great gossips. I can well imagine a Chambali saying, "Oh, look at him, trying to get attention with that new colored feather he's got in. He's overdressed, don't you think?" But being dependent on women, they were always worried about the impression they were making on women. Women became, or were, the superior, confident, cool, cooperative, feet on the ground, acerb, matter-of-fact, and practical sex, while the men were the narcissistic, aesthetic, sensitive, easily hurt, coquettish sect. It was not that women did not appreciate men and liked to have them around. It was simply that men were merely decorative and entertaining, but not the important sex, and so they should not be taken too seriously. Paul Schilder differed sharply from Freud over the nature of psychological sex differences. Schilder thought that beyond differing actions relative to sexual anatomy, sex functions, and behavior, all differences rose from social and cultural factors. Margaret Mead represents an extreme cultural form of the Schilder position. By contrast, Freud firmly believed that anatomy is destiny, and that there are some basic psychological givens in masculinity and femininity. Being both a human biologist and a cultural anthropologist, my position is necessarily between that of Freud and Schoeldrich. I think that as a psychological experience, growing up in one kind of body is bound to be a different learning experience than growing up in another kind of body. On this level, sexuality is learned, but on the basis of anatomical givens. For example, as soon as a little boy learns that girls are different, then vulnerability to mutilation and loss of genitals as a punishment for naughty acts or fantasies gives a quite different castration complex to a male than to a female. To a girl, usually, it's not fair the boys have what she does not. And what has she done to be so punished? Again, the grossly distinctive features of males, external genitals, are present at birth, but boys are insignificantly little compared to grown men. Therefore, comparison, emulation, and competition are directly built into the male situation. A man always has to prove the distance he has moved from child to man, and his creativity is always secondary and symbolic. A woman proves her womanhood once and for all by the only true creativity, growing a new human being. Who needs to write the great American novel if she can have a baby and produce a real human lifetime? By contrast, anatomically, the distinctive overt trait of a woman, the breast, a little girl must long wait for. She has not even a token promise for the future, as a boy does. Again, the experience of a nocturnal emission to a boy at puberty just is different psychologically from the experience of menstruation in a girl, which reactivates all her old guilts and inhibitions from earlier cleanliness training, and if anything, menstruation only further confirms her earlier castration fantasies. In the boy, the nocturnal emission is a new, prideful, unalloyed body zone pleasure. But menstruation, defloration, and childbirth all mean that female sexuality is associated with pain. Truly, anatomy is destiny. And the experience of a larger muscled, big-boned body with larger lungs, higher metabolic rate, more oxygen-carrying red blood cells per cubic centimeter, all these things will inevitably teach a different stance toward life than a smaller, finer textured, differently vulnerable, and differently shaped body with more subcutaneous fat and all the rest. Every single male game, and athletics are quintessentially masculine, every single male game shows this projection of body image and emulation. The runner and swimmer must do it faster than competing males. The javelin, the shot put must go further. The boxer knocks down his opponent. The wrestler pins the other down under him in submission. In baseball, the man with the bat stands up against the whole of the team. In golf, the champion hits the ball harder and farther and more accurately toward the hole, and with fewer strokes. In all team games, one group of males tries to press another group shamefully backward, to force the symbolic ball into enemy territory or into his goal. And the winning team can dismantle the goalposts in football. In basketball, he can clip off the net from the basket. The very form of games is male in body image. To be the active invader, to avoid the passive fate of being invaded. And the mistake we get in the male who overvalues maleness is to demean the female for being different. It is not necessarily demeaning to be the receiver of love. Since males compete and emulate and compare, males are also, I think, the generalization makers, the lawmakers, and the abstractionists of basic principles in comparisons. Partly this results from his different Oedipal fate. The male must give up his concrete, specific, physical, oral-dependent love of his mother for a protective, aggressive love of women. From beginning to end, he simply loves women, though in physiologically different body zone ways, with opposite patterns of dominance dependence, and certainly different women. With some difficulty, he may even be induced to settle down with one woman and go through the forms, at least, of monogamy. Male sexuality is intense, embattled, and burdened with proof, but it's psychologically less complex. In this sense, there's something basically male, even the Berdash. His beadwork must be better than any other woman's. And it's shameful to her husband if the Berdash goes hunting for food. Now, the female, by contrast, must always change the sex of her original sex object. From the little girl's mother to her father to some other man. In the process, for good biological reasons, she is allowed to retain far more of the child's dependency than the man, who must change his dependency direction completely. A woman's proof of her sexuality is a baby. And to obtain a baby, a woman must first obtain a man. Again, a male can never be in doubt as to whether he is sexually aroused, but a woman actually may not know. Female sexuality is less embattled than male sexuality, but it's more obscure, more subtle, and much more complex. Women can understand men magnificently. Men find it hard to understand women. Why men love women is quite clear. As children, they had good biological reasons, given the job they had of growth, for loving their mothers. But why women love men is difficult to see. Besides, I mean in terms seriously of childhood conditioning. Besides, women have more physiological ways of loving than men do. If men cannot understand the prodigies of concern a woman can have for another in her baby, well, that's simply because males don't have female bodies. And what strikes me here is that male pediatricians suppose they can do anything better than women, just like Berdashes, including suckling the young. And on physiological, mammalian, evolutionary, biochemical, and a dozen other grounds, I think this is one thing women can do better than men. Nevertheless, in her loving, the female, it seems to me, is the concrete particularizer. She loves this baby and this man. Furthermore, there is a biological double standard that nobody can do anything about. A male can impregnate an indefinite number of females in a short time, but when a female is pregnant, she is pregnant, with massive physiological changes quite lacking in the male, and ordinarily only one pregnancy at a time. On these anatomical grounds, I do not see how we can differ from Freud. At the same time, it's certain that differences in the social context of conditioning can make for distinctly different end products. When I lived in an old-fashioned backwoods part of southwestern China, I was struck by the fact that the men seemed curiously devious, psychologically on the qui vive, feminine, inscrutable Orientals and all that stuff. Whereas the women seemed hard-bitten and matter-of-fact and tough and masculine. This is a racial difference. Only in time did I learn the cultural circumstances. This conservative and remote part of China around Kunming, Chongqing, still had the old extended patrilineal family. A male group, male descended, lived together for a number of generations. This means that from the day he was born until the day he died, and even thereafter for that matter as an ancestor, a man was caught up in a complex web of kinship relations that he had to adapt to as son, nephew, cousin, grandson, all the rest. In the preservation of face, which for all its delicacy is a male engendered thing, it's largely concerned for the other person's status, dignity, personal feelings, and the like, a male must learn to become a sensitive and astute psychologist in his complex relationships with other members of his patrilineal family. The Confucian ethic, in fact, is simply a statement of ideal behavior in different categories of interpersonal relationships. By contrast, the female must always marry away from her father's family to the patrilocal, where the father is, home of her husband. She entered an alien, male-centered group as a daughter-in-law, under the tutelage of her mother-in-law, her husband's mother. There was no special sympathy or sex solidarity here. Mother-in-law had started out as a daughter-in-law herself. The daughter-in-law's status depended entirely on her ability to work for her husband's family and to produce children, preferably boys, for her husband's patrilineage. In her old age, she might enjoy high status as the oldest living ancestress of the group. But it is a status that she has worked hard for all her life. That is to say, in this classical Chinese situation, the life space, culturally and socially, of a male puts a premium on his developing psychological skills, as was the case for a woman among us, certainly, in extremely patriarchal families, 50 and 100 years ago. I don't think women are in XXXY chromosome terms instinctually better psychologists than men, nor are Chinese men instinctively better psychologists than women. It's a question of learned adaptation to life space and role. For the Chinese female, on the other hand, like us, the premium was on working hard and getting ahead on her own. Thus, the traits that we designate here as masculine and feminine are not sexual absolutes at all, but rather they are characteristic psychological responses of human beings to culturally defined roles for the sexes. There are not only comparative ethnographic tribal differences in tertiary sexuality, but also, number 10, differences of pattern in time. Sexuality goes through marked historical changes in style. In the Renaissance, long-haired Florentine youngsters may have had more sexual experience than their modern equivalents in age. Yes, and have led armies too. Louis XIV wore silks and powdered hair, but he was then probably the most powerful man alive. Silks were status signals then, not sexual ones as now. We even give sex to furs. I understand that raccoon, when it's used now, can be ambisextrous, but mink, except in some notorious examples, mink is still a female fur. I believe pony skin is usable by both sexes, and so on. In every generation, in every tribe, we set up rigid norms and stereotypes, and temporary ones, about what men and women are like, and then are very unhappy that only statistically few individuals can actualize these ideal extreme cases. More than that, our tertiary dichotomies are sometimes very illogical and downright silly. For example, it is a common cliche that only males can create great art. I've suggested that it's their life space and their inability to create individuals and the like. Men are in their situation, if they're going to compete with women, can only do it symbolically. Maybe it's so that only males can create great art because only males in large numbers are motivated to do it in our society. But then we say that only females can be preoccupied with and can enjoy art, which is a patent absurdity. Furthermore, why is it that the most virile men, as defined by their being self-made millionaires, like Morgan and Mellon and Carnegie and Frick, choose to collect and enjoy art? There is no connection here between chromosomes and aesthetic appreciation. And why is it that engineers who test high in masculinity in our Terman Miles masculinity femininity tests, why is it that engineers also tend to enjoy the works of Bach? I refuse to let anyone bully me out of my enjoyment of Baroque music and Italian Renaissance painting and modern painting. I would suggest that understanding and enjoying the music of Bach, for example, has nothing whatever to do with XXXY chromosomes, and if engineers enjoy the complex structures of counterpoint, then that's probably because engineering minds tend to enjoy complex dynamic structures of whatever kind, and it's no imputation on the engineer that he likes counterpoint. We cannot be human unless we have elaborate codes for behavior. But perhaps Herbert Marcuse is right in asking, what are the codes that will deliver the greatest amount of potential enjoyment and self-fulfillment for the least cost of inhibitions and repression and discipline? In other terms, is man made for culture, or are cultures made for man? Actually, every changing generation in its tertiary sexual characteristics is made up from a mosaic of traits taken from both father and mother in learning terms, just as genetic physical traits are a mosaic of traits from mother and father. Let me give a simple example of what I mean. In our society at present, the doctor enjoys high social status, in part indicated by the high income of doctors, in part by our legislative attempts to subsidize doctors through health insurance and other means. Strangely enough, against the doctor's most extreme and vociferous objections. Why this irrational fight against self-interest? From teaching many generations of young doctors in medical schools, I think I have something like an answer. In my judgment, a good doctor has some intensely masculine traits in terms of competitively high status, intention to have a respect-worthy income, intensity of discipline to remote symbolic ends, willingness to accept responsibility, and so on. The doctor wants to be symbolically the father, so far as his complete authority goes. And thus his objection to any governmental or public authority, for he sees it as a dilution of his own total male authority. But at the same time, every good doctor also has gotten from his mother a feminine concern for other people, especially the weak and the sick. That is more than the ordinary endowment of a male. In fact, it's not male at all in life space terms. It's really closer to the normal biological roles of the female in nurturing and protecting life. Thus, without in any way impugning the essential maleness of the doctor, it's plain that in this matter he is a mosaic of so-called masculine and feminine traits. Rattray Taylor, in fact, thinks that one of the major hidden motors in social change is just this mosaic of identifications in which each generation subtly changes. A generation which primarily identifies with the father is patrist, and one that identifies primarily with the mother is matrist. And they're mixtures of them. And there are areas in which there's identification and non-identification. But in general, in extreme form, the patrist ethos is authoritarian, directive, paternalist, and restrictive. The matrist, libertarian, nurturant, and democratic. The patrist is absolutist and conservative. The matrist, relativist, and progressive. The patrist father identifier has a resentment of women because the mother is the basis of the conflict between father and son, and to patrists, women are inferior and sinful. You can think about historical periods to which these apply, I think. With the mother identifier, there is a high status and freedom of women. Patrist orthodoxy is countered by matrist freedom of inquiry. Interference with a patrist regime is crime. Intervention in a matrist regime takes the form of nurturant social welfare and insurance. The father identifying patrist is a rigid and fiercely loyal, compulsive traditionalist. The matrist is a spontaneous, creative innovator. The patrist distrusts research and intellectual inquiry as weakening authoritarian orthodoxy. The matrist espouses research to change the regime for the better, and hence the matrist tends toward formal heresy. Patrists who love and exalt male things have anxiety over homosexuality. Mother-identifying matrists over incest. Patrist prostitution is opposed to matrist promiscuity or free love or sexual emancipation. The patrist seeks to maximize sexual differences because he benefits from them, conceptually and in dress. The matrist minimizes sex differences. From this quick sketch, it would seem that from about the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt, our society has had a matrist trend. I don't mean to imply any kind of invidious judgments about males and females, except to suggest that a total society needs both masculinity and femininity. Of course, it's possible to reject identification with both parents and to abandon the values of both, but it's almost like being a human dropout, to become this rather sterile dropout pattern of age mate, ad hoc living and values that are essentially anti-cultural, antinomian. The hallmark of this kind of anomie is aimlessness and the tyranny of conformity to disconformity. It is highly stereotyped and limiting and requires you to make, when you cut off from the past, the same old mistakes that have been made in the past. In America today, politically, economically, and socially, the main trend of our society seems recently to be again toward the patrist. And this patrist dispensation is viewed with alarm by those who would wish to diminish the unrestrained power of the military-industrial complex and who would prefer a Peace Corps aid to a Vietnam interventionist relation with other countries. Unrestrained power may be masculine, but it's not always socially useful. The differences between matrist and patrist are pervasive and deep, and individual preferences tend to be clear. Some people prefer the right-thinking security of terrorist orthodoxy, under which the main problem is merely enforcing obedience to conformity. Others prefer the anxiety, the excitement, and the anomie of relativism. It's possible that the immediate new generation is puzzling because it's neither patrist nor classical matrist. In any case, the present-day alienation from patrist authority and continuity, which is necessary too, is quite extreme. Whether that authority be the demeaned and ridiculed father, the father in the TV who's always a clown, and Blondie and Mom always know better. He's always bested. As a male, I refuse to believe that being a father and a man is quite that ridiculous as it's presented. But we have the demeaned and ridiculed father. We have the recent president reject, and something of a tragedy, who doesn't know yet quite what happened to him. The papal authority over some very serious life matters is out of touch. The police, the college student, and in some cases college administrations, when presumably you should be about the same goals, or the establishment in general. I think there is, to me, a somewhat disconcerting anti-patrist, anti-authority, antinomian discontinuity. Maybe something good will come from it. But I feel the same way about it that I feel about genes. Throwing a monkey wrench into delicate machinery is only rarely going to benefit it. And cosmic rays going into germ cells only very rarely is going to make for a good mutation. And pure destructive antinomianism is only very rarely going to produce a better world. But the rejection of patrist personalities, meanwhile, has been building up tremendously. And the patrist may be slated now for a period in the saddle. I regret it because it's so extreme. Men overwhelm opposition. Women undermine it. And the social style of the corresponding institutions correspondingly contrast. It seems to me that in the ethos of a decent society, if there are essentially masculine and feminine or male and female traits, we certainly need them both, because the extremes are distressing chaos of relativism or an absolutely cramping patrist imprisonment in right thinking. I've suggested to you some 10 levels on which we may discuss sexuality. Probably there are more, but there exist at least these. Part of the problem is that one cannot always pretend to know at which level, to which level, any specific item should be assigned. Is tenderness toward another person unmasculine? As a human biologist, one might tend to be over-instinctivist. But as a cultural anthropologist, one might be just as prone to be over-relativistic. Meanwhile, as a humanist, I know that there are always changing styles and many ways of being human. To be human is to be constantly burdened with self-definition. And perhaps so long as the individual continues to grow, the achieving of an absolute and static identity will always elude him. I have tried to steer here a course between Scylla and Charybdis, the rock of dogma and the whirlpool of relativist chaos. The main principle I espouse is that we should not fear but should cherish human differences of whatever kind. And not to be too fanatical in categorizing them, and not to be too invidious in saying that one is good and the other is bad. Ulysses, after long turmoil and more than one time being lost, made it home finally to Ithaca and Penelope. However you define and redefine home, I hope you will make it too.
On behalf of all of us attending here this evening, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Labar, for helping us to examine not only our own peculiar customs and folklore regarding sexuality, but also those of the world in which we live. Thank you for attending.